KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's second Forum Hour, we'll talk with the man who may well be the world's most famous writer of fiction. Salman Rushdie joins us for a conversation all about his newest novel, which is called Shalimar the Clown. We'll talk with him as well about the minds of terrorists, the Indian-Pakistani conflict over Kashmir, and what New York Times columnist Tom Friedman calls the flattening of the world, and much more, with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Salman Rushdie is probably the world's best-known novelist, in great part because of the fatwa put out on him by Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini, which, as he has explained, took close to a decade of his life. Khomeini, in effect, ordered his death for his having written the novel The Satanic Verses. He's the author of five works of nonfiction, a collection of short stories, and a number of novels. In addition to The Satanic Verses, which include Midnight's Children, which won the coveted Booker Prize, Shame, The Moor's Last Sigh, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, and Fury. His most recent novel is called Shalimar the Clown. It's an epic about a Kashmiri acrobat turned assassin, the ambassador he murders, and two women, the ambassador's daughter India and the woman who connects them. Salman Rushdie joins us for this morning's second hour forum, and good to see you again.
Hi, nice to be back.
Well, where to begin with this? I guess maybe begin with the genesis, as is often the case with the new novel, at least. It goes back to your doing a documentary back in the late 80s, I guess.
That's right. It was 87, which was the 40th anniversary of Indian independence. And I guess because of Midnight's Children, having dealt with that period, I was asked by British television to make a sort of personal view of India at 40, sort of essay documentary. And as part of the research trip for that, we visited Kashmir, which I was anxious to get into the film, and met a group of traveling players, not unlike the ones in the book. And they were very sweet to me in that very open Kashmiri way. And
traveling players makes one think of Hamlet or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Well, it's exactly like that. It's like the player king and his team, you know. But it's an old tradition in Kashmir of having this village-based folk theatre, which performs traditional plays about bits of Kashmiri history. There's a play about a well-known king called Zainul Abidin, who was a legendary unifier and tolerant man who united the Hindus and Muslims and so on. There's a play called The Narcissus and the Butterfly, which is very sort of an allegory of Kashmir. And they do these things, and they're very skillful. You know, they're in that old kind of commedia dell'arte style. They're very, very good performers. And yet, it's a dying art form, you know, because in the age of TV and movies and so on, who wants to go see traveling village folk theater? You know, it's a small audience. But they took me to their village and I saw this way of life they had of handing down the skills through the generations. You know, it was kind of, in a way, magical to be in little woodland groves where parents were teaching children how to walk tightropes and do traditional dances and so on. And at the same time, it was very poignant because they had no money, not only because the folk theater was dying out, but because also the already Kashmir was in a state of economic depression and so on. And clearly, this was before the explosion of the insurgency in 89. Now they must be even much worse off.
And they were also telling you stories that they wouldn't tell on camera.
Yeah, they told me all these stories about their lives and the hardship they had from both sides, both from the Indian Army and from the Pakistan-backed radicals coming across the border. But every time we switched on the camera and said, okay, tell us your story, they would say, we are very happy. I said, what do you mean you're very happy? You were just telling me how you were very unhappy. And they said, no, we are very happy. And so we, in the end, had to leave them out of the film because we couldn't get them to tell the truth on camera. But they really stuck with me, those people, in that place. And I've been looking for many years to find a way to tell a story about Kashmir. And
you yourself are Kashmiri?
Yeah, I'm 75% for sure. It's a bit. My mother's family is 100% Kashmiri. My father's family is more than half. And that gave me a lifelong feeling of deep affection for the place and personal connection with what's been happening there, and it's taken me all this time to find a way of telling the story.
Well, certainly embedded in this novel, the whole story, historically, as well as the more magical and mythical side of Kashmir, which turns out to be almost pre-lapsarian in terms of lost paradise.
You know, it really does feel like that. I mean, you know, the higher mountain valley of Kashmir, which, of Ladakh, is actually the valley on which James Hilton based the idea of Shangri-La. You know, so it's always had this sense of being a magic space, you know, magic, enchanted space high up in these giant mountains. You know, one of the characters in the novel describes it as a green sweetmeat caught in a giant's teeth. And that's, it's kind of what it feels like. It's very, very lush, unlike a lot of India, which is parched and brown. You know, Kashmir is very fertile and green and full of flower meadows and saffron fields and fruit orchards and honeybees and so on. It's kind of beautiful lakes. And I mean, it is spectacularly lovely. And not only is there this physical beauty, there was also a kind of human beauty where people had actually learned how to live together. You know, it's one of those bits of the world where people found out how to get on with each other, whether they were Hindus or Muslims or in the main, but also Sikhs and small number of Christians and Jews.
Well, what an irony, because now one of the most divisive places in the world.
So, you know, such an irony, because Kashmir used to be the place that the rest of India made jokes about how people in Kashmir had no martial spirit at all, you know, in the way that one would make, you know, Polish jokes or whatever. You know, the Kashmiri jokes were all about the cowardice of Kashmiris because they had no aggressive spirit. And it's incredibly painful to see a place which was so harmonious becoming the most violent and contentious place in the subcontinent.
This is a book about a kind of violence. I mean, it's a book about an assassination, maybe even, one might argue, the making of a terrorist mind. And in fact, the personal and the political become very involved here. I mean, we once talked about how we were both sort of shaped by the 60s, and you know, you're very open about the effect on you, but we used to say the personal is political, and now in some respects I see you coming to kind of different hillocks, one being maybe a merger of those two, and tell me if I'm wrong, but also a sense of something else we've talked about in the past. This is kind of A and B here, because they come together in my mind in some ways, how the old idea of a novel we both respect very much, Augie March, of, you know, shifting Heraclitus, maybe has gone back, that fate has become character in many ways.
I think that's very strange, isn't it? I mean, we do live in a time in which character is not always destiny, you know, I mean, in which it can work the other way around, that the thing that what happens to you can reform your character. You know, your destiny can be your fate.
And again, a lot to do with the violence and the apocalyptic nature of what we live with.
Yeah, right? I mean, you know, this was a book which really told me how to write it as I was writing it. It was very strange. I mean, I, in a way, had to abandon a lot of my early concept of the novel as the characters revealed what they were really about. You know, so that in my earliest vision of the book, probably this murder in which this Kashmiri clown ends up killing an American ambassador probably was political. You know, in my first concept, I thought maybe this is some kind of political murder, and what I'm talking about is, you know, power versus oppression and so on. And the book just was not interesting in that way. And so I then had to say, okay, well, who are these people that I'm thinking about if that's not who they are? And they then slowly revealed themselves to me in what was a much more interesting way, you know, in a much more human way. And their motivations became as much private and human as political. And it made me actually work my way back to the Heraclitus character as destiny formula, because what I thought is, even a young man who becomes a terrorist, you know, even a young man who goes through such an extraordinary transformation in his life can only be understood if you look inside his character, because, you know, many people in Kashmir felt oppressed either by the Indian army or by the Pakistani jihadists, whatever. Very few of them, or not all of them, become terrorists. So then the question is, why this boy and not the boy standing next to him? Why not his neighbor, you know, who suffers exactly the same privations, who lives in exactly the same world, and yet who does not pick up the gun and become a terrorist? And the answer is the old novelistic answer. You have to look inside, you have to see what it is in the character of Shalimar the clown that, if the right buttons are pushed, allows him to become that man of violence. And what is it that would not be in the character of his neighbor, you know, who would therefore not be able to become that man? So in the end, it does become an investigation of character.
I don't know if you saw this new study of suicide bombers, but it dovetails with what you're saying, because it turns out that many of them, of course, are not impoverished, they're middle class,
yes,
and many of them are educated. And what drives them is a sense of not only nationalism, obviously, but tremendous sense of personal humiliation.
Yes, humiliation is what it's about, you know, because humiliation in a culture which is based on, not on the Christian moral poles of guilt and redemption, you know, but on the Eastern moral poles of honor and shame. It's a very, very different mindset. And that's the thing to remember, because then what we may think of as humiliation gets the extra dimension of dishonor, which therefore has an effect of making people feel emasculated in their manhood. And in the attempt to recreate for themselves the sense of honor in their manhood, they can become violent people even if they never thought that about themselves. You know, and the other thing to be said is, actually one of the things I quite enjoyed doing in Shalimar the Clown, which I think I believe it to be true, is that the real jihadists, you know, the guys with guns, despise the suicide bombers. You know, they think of them as lowly. You know, that's kind of a class difference. I mean, all they're doing is strapping on a bomb and killing themselves. You know, bah.
Talking to Salman Rushdie, his new book is Shalimar the Clown. There's a kind of, flattening of the world here. You know, that's what Tom Friedman calls it in this new book of yours. You know, everywhere was now part of everywhere else, as it's put at one point. And in fact, what's striking about when the character says, "I am death," I mean, it has Hindu resonance, obviously, from the Bhagavad Gita. It goes back to Oppenheimer. I mean, you're trying to say something in a more global view here, aren't you?
It's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, yes, that's right. I mean, that when he says, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds," I mean, this is a famous line from the Bhagavad Gita. So it's entirely appropriate for it to be said in an Indian context. But, of course, the line became famous here because of Oppenheimer saying it on the day that the atom bomb...
And it's Hindu, of course.
And yes. It's Hindu, yes. Yeah. So it's also, yes, it's not even sectarian. But I've, you know, really my views about writing have changed during the last, you know, since I wrote Midnight's Children, because even though at the beginning of Midnight's Children, the narrator says, "To understand me, you have to swallow the world," this rather, you know, deliberately Whitman-esque formulation, he just means India, you know. I mean, when he says the world, he just means his world. And the only bit of the outside world that gets into the story is England because of the, you know, the colonial past. But otherwise, I didn't feel at that time that in order to fully explain the lives of those characters, I had to go outside the context of the Indian subcontinent. I could do it all in there, you know. And indeed, after that, when I wrote Shame, I actually deliberately resisted drawing the kind of geopolitical influences, you know, saying, of course, you can talk about a third world country and what goes wrong with it in terms of superpowers messing with its politics. But I thought, how much more interesting to pretend that it's our own fault, you know, and to write about it without looking at that geopolitical context. So, but now I find it's inescapable. You know, the world has so much shrunk for a number of reasons. I mean, partly because of mass migration, partly because of economic globalization, partly because of new mass communication media, you know, the internet and all that, partly because of this new internationalization of violence, you know, in the form of terrorism. All this means that we now really live cheek by jowl with people in other continents and other realities. And in order to explain the life, you know, of somebody in California, and after all, this is a book that begins with a murder in L.A., I thought I had to show that in order to explain that life, you actually have to go across the world. In order to explain the life of the dead man, Max, the ambassador, you have to talk about a youth in Europe in World War II, in Nazi-occupied Europe where he works in the resistance. In order to explain the life of the murderer, you have to go back and talk about his backstory in Kashmir, and actually to discover a curious balance between the two, because they've both been involved in insurgencies.
And a much more intricate view of history, really, a much more, in some ways, symbiotic notion of history, if you will. Max has a very prescient view of history in so many instances, and yet he says at one point, "India is chaos making sense." To some extent, that separates India still, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, "India is chaos making sense" is my rewriting the famous description of India by John Kenneth Galbraith, who described it as functioning anarchy. That is, I mean, it's the best description of India I've ever heard, you know, because certainly I think for somebody who's never been there, the experience of going to India for the first time is that of being plunged into a world which appears to have no rules, whether it's the traffic or the railway station or the politics. It seems to be completely free form, and yet it works. You know, I mean, here's a place of a billion people that has, with the exception of 2 years when Mrs. Gandhi suspended democratic rights, been a functioning democracy, you know, for 60 years now almost. And it's much harder to be a democracy in a poor country than in a rich country. And yet there it is. It's a place that works, although it's a spectacular mess.
And speaking of things that work, I don't know if L.A. works, but it is a spectacular mess. And indeed, the novel places us initially in L.A., and I just wanted for listeners to give a sense of how you describe L.A. here and then get your reaction to your own text. In such a city, there could be no gray areas, or so it seemed. Things were what they were and nothing else, unambiguous, lacking the subtleties of drizzle, shade, and chill. Under the scrutiny of such a sun, there was no place to hide. People were everywhere on display, their bodies shining in the sunlight, scantily clothed, reminding her that is India, the daughter of the ambassador of advertisements. No mysteries here or depths, only surfaces and revelations. Yet to learn the city was to discover that this banal clarity was an illusion. The city was all treachery, all deception, a quick change, quicksand metropolis hiding its nature, guarded and secret in spite of all its apparent nakedness. In such a place, even the forces of destruction no longer needed the shelter of the dark. They burned out of the morning's brightness, dazzling the eye, and stabbed at you with sharp and fatal light. I'm thinking, that's awfully good writing, Solomon. But I'm also thinking about, you know, the L.A. that we get through, say, Pynchon, or the L.A. we get through Nathaniel West, or the L.A. we get through Joan Didion. And in a sense, it's a different L.A.
Yeah, I like all those L.A.s. And I actually, one of the L.A.s I discovered when I was reading stuff for this book was the L.A. of James Ellroy, which I've, you know, given that there's a crime in the book, I thought I better read some crime stuff.
You read Chandler too? Or?
Yes, of course. But I think, you see, the thing that I felt learning Los Angeles in the last 6 or 7 years was that it is this paradoxical place. It looks as if it's all openness. You know, there's people dressed for warm weather all the year, not bundled up, you know, et cetera. But it's, in fact, the exact opposite of New York. In New York, the entire life of the city is on the sidewalk. You know, in L.A., the entire life of the city is behind gates somewhere. And if you can't get behind the gates, you have no idea what's really going on.
Or as Oscar Levant once said, under the tinsel is more tinsel. Yeah. Well, it is a city. New York can be a city gates, too, as soon as you get out of the city. But here's a city where Hollywood plays such a preeminent role. In fact, Max Ophuls, the ambassador, I don't give away too much of the plot here, but goes on one of these late-night talk shows, probably much more cerebral and intellectual than any we're apt to see on television, the mind of a novelist at work here. But he loves having him on to talk about, for example, liaison between Warren Beatty and Susan Sontag, things that one couldn't possibly imagine. There's that sense of that appetite for that, as opposed to talking about Kashmir, which is really what he wants to do.
Yeah, he's invited on because he's a raconteur, you know, and he's been in private conversations talking to the talk show host about his encounters with, you know, Brando and Wells and Beatty and so on. And so he's brought on to the show in order to tell funny stories about movie stars. And instead, he gets provoked and begins instead to deliver this political harangue about the horrors of Kashmir, which he remembers from his days as ambassador, which is the birthplace of the woman that he seduced and with whom he had an illegitimate child, who is India, the character you were mentioning. And of course, the talk show host is absolutely horrified. And hears the sounds of channels being changed all over America.
Ratings is dipping beyond belief. Ah, well, you know, you capture that very well, I must say. I mentioned Tom Friedman, you know, the world is flat before, and I was thinking about what he says to distinguish, say, Indian Muslims from other Muslims. And what also came to me, curiously enough, was your old friend Naipaul. I say that a little bit in italics. That very clever remark, you know, the worst kind of literary criticism was the fatwa and the satanic verses. I know you two don't see eye to eye politically, but he has also talked about the militancy of Islam, and yet Friedman says it doesn't really exist to that degree in India. Never has.
And you see, in Kashmir in particular, the kind of Islam that always existed in Kashmir until the last couple of decades was the polar opposite of what we now think of as radical Islam. You know, as I was saying, there were jokes made about the lack of militancy of Kashmiris. And that's because the kind of Islam there was kind of mystical. It was very Sufi influenced. It was very, very mild. And not only that, but it had become kind of adulterated by Hinduism a bit, in the same way as Kashmiri Hinduism had got adulterated by Islam a little bit, you know. And the two things at the edges were sort of bleeding into each other. And so it was a very non-militant Islam. And actually, I think for for Kashmiris, the arrival of that militant Islam from across the Pakistan border was really traumatic and continues to be. And elsewhere in India also, you see, because one of the things that Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru understood at the independence of India was that in order to protect minorities, like, the, of course, the biggest minority is the Muslim minority, you had to secularize the constitution, you had to create a genuinely secular democracy, which is what India was created it to be, really in order to avoid it becoming a dictatorship of the Hindu majority. And as a result, Indian Muslims have always understood that secularism is what protects them. You know, and as a result, they have always been totally secularized. They have always opposed the mixing of religion and politics and so on. And so the development of Islam in the Indian subcontinent or in India has been very different to across the border in Pakistan.
So the neocons thought would happen in Iraq because there was such secularism in Iraq.
Yeah, it worked there.
We're going to get off on that. but you had this article in the Washington Post about, help me with the pronunciation, Sir Iqbal...
Sakrani,
who... I guess you see as maybe the new idea of moderate Islam, at least from the Tony Blair point of view?
Or? You know, well, Blair is certainly has certainly embraced a group of quite orthodox conservative Muslim leaders as his idea of moderate Muslims. And what I've been trying to argue is that, in fact, they are not moderate Muslims. I mean, they're not terrorists. You know, they're not in favor of blowing things up. And indeed, they have.
Well, this is a guy who said death would be perhaps too easy for you.
Yes. He was. He's not a very nice man, and he certainly wasn't particularly nice to me. But to give him his due, he has been an opponent of Islamic terrorism, and the so-called Muslim Council of Britain, which he leads. Is an umbrella organization which, broadly speaking, contains Muslim groups which are opposed to the radicals. However, they themselves are very conservative Muslim groups. So actually, this is not a group out of which any kind of modernizing spirit would come. I mean, they're very orthodox, old-fashioned people. And my worry is that if you look at the actual population in England, and indeed here, I think, the very large bulk of it, in fact, is integrated, secularized, and modernized in its attitudes, and yet has no political voice. You know, and the great lack.
Why is that? I mean, it just really doesn't have a political.
Because in a way, you know, they just vote for political parties because they're, you know, citizens first and Muslims second.
Or maybe there's this kind of binary divide between the absolutists and those who are more secular. And I mean, in effect, the article that I read that you did in the Washington Post is calling for reform to bridge that gap, to make it more modern.
And that's true here as well. In fact, it's even more true here, where I think the Muslim community in America is, you know, by and large, middle class, well-educated, sophisticated, and extremely well-integrated, you know. And yet, every time the media need a Muslim voice, they have to go to some mosque in Jersey and produce some bearded imam to offer extremely conservative points of view. And therefore, the actual views of most Muslims in America or in Britain are not being voiced publicly, you know, because there is no there are individuals who voice them, but there is no institution that represents those views. And I'm saying it's a big hole and it needs to be filled.
Talking to Salman Rushdie, his new book is Shalimar the Clown, a novel, and you are welcome to join us. If you care to do that, you can do it toll-free at 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786, or email any questions or comments you might have. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and Salman Rushdie will be at Book Passage this afternoon and around lunchtime at noon, and we'll give you also other places that he'll be appearing here in the Bay Area. We welcome your calls and emails. We'll go to them when we return. We'll talk more with the author of the new novel, Shalimar the Clown. I'm Michael Krasny. Tuesday on Forum, in the opening hour, we'll talk about the nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court by President Bush. And in the second hour, African-American psychiatrist Price Cobbs will be our guest, the co-author of Black Rage. We'll be talking about his new memoir. Later on this week, we'll be talking about the anti-war movement. We'll also be talking with primatology expert Robert Sapolsky and with novelist Louise Erdrich. And we'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum, suggestions, reactions, or feedback of any kind, you can email it to us, forum@kqed.org, or you can call our listener call and response line at 415-553-3300. And visit us on our website. Go to www.kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with novelist and writer Salman Rushdie. His new novel is Shalimar the Clown, talking off-air about a couple of things, including the name Shalimar, which I've said publicly on a few occasions that people don't rend Christopher Hitchens and other people who have had any association with Salman Rushdie know how funny he can be. Saying maybe Shalimar Cologne ought to be get some rights or connection, commercial connections.
No, I think we should obviously do some joint advertising. You know, since we both got the name from the same place. And the Shalimar Garden in Kashmir was built. It's a beautiful, you know, formal garden, terraced garden down the side of the hill, with waterfalls and, you know, fountains and so on. But it was built in the 17th century, I guess, by the Mughal Emperor Jahangir. Who liked gardens, and it actually means abode of joy, and yeah, if the perfume has stolen the name from Kashmir, I think I'm entitled to a slice.
You've got a view that Kashmir really needs to be demilitarized. I mean, that's kind of priority, isn't it? As you see,
well, you know, if you think about it, it's a very small place, Kashmir. I mean, physically, it's a very small mountain valley surrounded by, you know, gigantic mountains, but the actual Vale of Kashmir, so-called, is not a large place. And it has a population of barely 5 and a bit million people. And amongst those 5 and a bit million people, you've got, at the moment, 900,000 Indian soldiers, 700,000 Pakistani soldiers across the ceasefire line, the so-called line of control. And that's not including the jihadist, you know, groups, the terrorist groups. So you've got more than 1.5 million highly armed people moving amongst this valley of, you know, 5 million peaceful people. And you can only imagine how oppressive that feels. And even I remember going to Kashmir in the 1980s when I met the traveling players, as I was saying, on whom the book was based. You would see army convoys on narrow mountain roads, which would go on for hours. I mean, like 4 hours, 5 hours, jeeps, trucks, tanks, you know, heavy artillery being drawn around these narrow mountain roadways. And it was extraordinary. I mean, you go down the main streets of the little capital city of Srinagar, and almost round every corner there's a colossal army camp with camouflaged weaponry and so on. And it feels like an occupation. Of course it does. You know, how could it not when you've got that many people there? And at the same time, you've got these terrorists coming in and forcing Kashmiris to behave in a way they've never behaved. I mean, for instance, you know, there's a scene in the book where the women of the village are threatened by jihadists, you know, to start being more, as the jihadists would say, more decent, you know, covering themselves up. Kashmiri women never wore the veil.
It's a very powerful scene, and all too reminiscent of Taliban, of course.
Yeah, which, and I mean, you know, I come from a family in which is a very female family. I mean, women in my family outnumber the men by more than 3 to 1. You know, I have no brothers, I have 3 sisters, and so on and so on. But there is not a single woman in my family, from not just this generation, but going back to my grandparents and even great-grandparents, who would ever have worn the veil, who would ever have consented to be sequestered in any way, who would ever have agreed to an arranged marriage, who would ever have thought that women should not work or that women were in any way inferior to men. You know, and that in Kashmir, there was a long tradition of, you know, relative equality between the sexes. And suddenly along comes this, you know, ancient medievalist idea of Islam, which starts threatening women with physical danger if they don't start covering up and behaving decently and et cetera, et cetera. And now you tragically do see in Kashmir women who are obliged out of fear to cover themselves up. In the novel, they get a bit of their revenge.
Yes. So we were talking a little bit off, I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment, but a little bit off microphone about, some of you may remember the appearance of Cat Stevens on Forum, and he said some pretty harsh words, which were brought to his attention when he was on here with us, about you and about satanic verses, and we had kind of a different narrative, at least on the air, that well, said the words weren't quite as harsh. Again, the press blew them up, out of context and so forth.
That's not right. I mean, Cat Stevens is now attempting to rewrite what he said in 1989 because it's obviously, at the time, he thought it was cool, you know, to express radical Islamic views. And now that the world has gone on and found out a little bit more about radical Islam, he discovers it's uncool and no doubt his record sales are suffering. But now he's trying to pretend he didn't say things that he did say. And it's not just I who heard them. There are many, many journalists in England who interviewed him who are able to say they've got it on record. They've got it in their notes. They've got it on tape. They've got it on videotape. He was completely vocally supporting calls for my death. And for him now to say that he wasn't, he's just been misquoted, is just, you know, he's just hoping that people don't have a memory. You know, well, actually, I certainly do.
Well, the record sales, by the way, he renounced all that rock and roll, as I'm sure you well know.
Now no, but he's de-renounced it.
Well, now he's going back, or apparently trying to go back. But at that time, he was just putting out Islamic-type religious music.
No, I guess he needs some money now.
We'll go to your calls. Let's do that forthwith. David, good morning.
Yeah, morning. Great honor. You know, I wanted to really ask about something that had been kind of plaguing me ever since I heard about the fatwa that was put out on you. And that's, would you be able to name some very similar Christians that have the same kind of, to give America the kind of comparison that we need to be able to point out similar people? And as I was waiting, I also wanted to ask you, you were talking about Kashmir, and it's my understanding that Kashmir has been eyed by many of the oil companies for years. You mentioned that Kashmir is a valley. Would seem that, is that a valley that would be very helpful to oil pipelines, and that the reason why Lord Mountbatten didn't draw it into the maps was because the possibility of using it as a how would you call it, a city without without portfolio. I'm trying to, if it has no borders, then there are no taxes to be paid by running oil through that pipeline. And then finally, I guess actually Jubilee, the idea that whether many of these problems that lead up to this fatwa and the religious ferocity on all sides, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, whether or not a jubilee might be useful in these troubled times.
Not sure what you mean by a jubilee, but it brings up a couple of interesting points here. I mean, the idea, there's often been this analogy between evangelicals and fervent Christians here and some of the imams and fervent militant Muslims. I guess Pat Robertson put out a quasi-fatwa on Hugo Chavez, but notwithstanding, mm-hmm. I mean, the analogy has always seemed strained to me.
Yeah, I don't think it quite works because I don't think there has been an attempt quite like this, you know, coming out of the Christian tradition, because the thing that was unusual in this case was that Khomeini's Iran was not only a radical Islamic state, it was also a state which was completely ready to use that kind of violence, terrorist violence, in the pursuance of its aims. So it wasn't just about me. I mean, they would deliberately target opponents in other countries for assassination and so on. So it was, in a way, I don't think it's about religion. It's about the particular fascist politics that have developed in bits of the Muslim world which use Islam as a kind of cloak. Certainly, as I say, if you think about the story of this book, where you have, you know, peaceful Muslims being oppressed by non-peaceful Muslims. You know, the peaceful Muslims are not less Muslim than the non-peaceful ones. They simply have a different picture of the religion, which is much less politicized, much less militarized, actually much less fascistic. So I think one thing that's important to remember is that the people first and most directly oppressed by Islamic radicalism are other Muslims. You know, the people who were most oppressed by the Taliban were Afghan Muslims. The people most oppressed today by the rule of the Ayatollahs in Iran are Iranian Muslims. And that was true in Algeria, and that's true in Kashmir, that's true wherever you look.
Caller also brings up a point about oil in Kashmir.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, Kashmir is a little bit pre-industrial at the moment, I mean, largely because it's been such a battleground. Neither side has been willing to invest in industrializing it. It's very rich in natural resources, that is true. I mean, there's believed to be an enormous amount of certainly mineral riches unmined, you know, in the mountains. And it is very rich in fertile, so it's very rich in produce, you know, et cetera. So it is a very fertile and as I say, in mineral terms, I don't know about oil. And I think it would be quite hard to run a pipeline, actually, via Kashmir because of the mountains. You know, it's very difficult to get the pipeline across the mountains. So I'm not sure it would be useful for that reason.
We'll go to more of your calls. And Abdul, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Neil. Yeah, I'm calling. I want to respond to the point that Solomon just made. Good morning, Solomon.
Good morning.
Yes, the point that you make about the idea of the media representing the views of Muslims in America in particular. You brought the point that when the incident happened, especially in the United States, you know, they would go to somewhere in New Jersey and find a Muslim or imam with long beard, and which does not actually represent the population of modern-day American Muslims.
Yes.
And that's a point that needs to be well taken and considered by the media when they try to get the views of Muslims in America. Another point also I wanted to make, and this is just basically to question you. I know you have written extensively about Islam and different parts of the world and tradition, but I want to caution you that also there are certain things that are going on is cultural in these countries, and it has nothing to do with Islam per se.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is also, what is actually your agenda, and what is your purpose of you writing extensively about this point? Are you trying to educate the world about what Islam supposed to be, or you are just a critic who trying to just bring out the things that supposed to be changed, or criticizing because of from an intellectual perspective? What is your agenda and what is your purpose? And I'll take my answer up the hair.
Right. Well, I think it's a good question. And I think that I would answer in two parts. First of all, if I'm writing novels, novels are not really written with a political agenda. They're written out of stuff that matters to the writer. And the reason I wrote this novel, for instance, is because the story of Kashmir and the way in which that story interacts with the story of the rest of the world is something I've really been wanting to talk about for a long time, partly because, as we were saying, my family originally came from there. It's a place I've been going ever since I was a small child. It's a place for which I have really deep love and feeling, and I've been very saddened by what has happened there. And that's where Shalimar the Clown comes from. It comes from an attempt to make a story which brings to life for people the reality of lives in another part of the world. I think it's one of the things, actually, that fiction can do, and that fiction does very well, is to create imaginatively worlds which readers can inhabit, which are not the world in which they live, but as a result of which they become part of the world in which they live. You know, this was, for me, I learned about Latin America through literature. I learned about Russia through literature. Actually, I learned about the United States through literature long before I got here.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Latin America, because I think the first time I had occasion to talk to you publicly was about the Jaguar Smile when you had gone to Nicaragua, which was more of a, call it a pedagogical book or a polemic in sense. But novels are not that, though.
They're not that. They're about this other thing, about creating worlds through which the readers can better understand the world. I mean, it is true, and the caller is right, that I have written nonfiction about the Muslim world. And there, I think both the things the caller mentioned are part of my interest. One is to increase the level of information that exists in parts of the world where the subject is not very well understood, and partly to critique the problems inside that world, which really do need, in my view, to be addressed. So it's both things at once.
Of course, the epigram speaks volumes when you choose Mercutio's words. You know, plague on both your houses.
A plague on both your houses. Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first thought about using that epigram, it was because of saying that, in a way, Kashmiris have got caught between, you know, the rock of India and the hard place of Pakistan. They've got kind of squeezed in between. But also, I think, as the book developed, it became a study of two worlds, that's to say, a Western paradise like California and an Eastern paradise like Kashmir, being essentially screwed up in different ways. You know, so it also became... those two houses, if you like, also became something that the novel tried to balance.
East and West.
Mm-hmm.
Former President Clinton once said that he talked about the fight over Kashmir between Pakistan and India as being perhaps the most volatile and serious issue in the world, even including Palestine and Israel and so forth, in terms of the potential for nuclear showdown and so forth. Seems to be certainly some movements toward peace, or there seems to be some optimism, doesn't there?
I hope so. There's just, I mean, the last couple of years... There's a slight change in the rhetoric, and that's very good. You know, and I mean, the solution being most touted is that India and Pakistan should both hold on to what they've got. I mean, at the moment, Pakistan holds on to about the northern one-third of the historical area of Kashmir, and India has the southern two-thirds. And through the middle of that, there runs the so-called line of control or ceasefire line. The solution being offered is just to turn that into an international frontier and let both sides hold on to the bit they've got and, you know, call it quits. Which, I mean, as if I hope that they can work that out. And there's, as you rightly say, there's some grounds to believe that might happen. My worry is that if that's all that happens, that it might not, in fact, demilitarize the valley, because the reason for the armies being there is that both sides fear that if either side backs off, the other side will make a land grab, you know. And it remains to be seen whether that fear can be assuaged. Because, you know, if not, the armies stay there and nothing changes. You just call the line something different.
Go to more of your calls. We go to Ray. Hi, Ray.
Salutations.
Hello there.
Salman. And best wishes in your safe journey.
Thank you. I wonder
if you've thought about the rhetoric, leaving aside for a moment the ideological contest, the rhetoric of the so-called war on terror calls to mind, at least in English, that there would be, if it's not just to be the last warrior standing, that there would be a particular moment when it would be decided win, lose, or draw, and some kind of negotiation would have to be carried out, as those of us have expected wars to be concluded, not to be eternal.
Yes.
Now, in the so-called war on terror, who negotiates the peace, or is this a dilemma, a paradox that we can't possibly resolve?
You know, I think, I mean, I share a lot of your feelings, but it does seem as if a little bit, it might be an interminable war. It's very difficult when even a political leader as powerful as the President of the United States declares as his aim the eradication of evil, because that might actually be beyond even the powers of an American president.
He's also indicated that this may indeed be a long, long war.
It may be a long, long war. And I mean, you see, my view is that there are two things. There's, on the one hand, a specific conflict against specific terrorist groups which have attacked the United States and are likely to wish to do so again. And that's a rather narrowly defined military conflict, which doesn't, by the way, in my view, include the current mess in Iraq. However, in the end, I think what will bring this terrorist phase in Islam to an end is more to do with what happens inside Muslim communities themselves. I mean, I think if you look at the Irish comparison, the reason the IRA in the end made peace was because they lost their own constituency. You know, that the Irish, Northern Ireland Roman Catholics really got sick of having all this these terrorist acts carried out in their name. And at that point, the IRA, not having the backing of its own side, so, you know, was obliged to lay down its weapons.
So an alternative would be for us to try to make common cause with the moderates you're describing in the Muslim communities.
Exactly. I think that would be the best thing that the West can do, and to strongly encourage Muslim countries, governments, and so on, to not allow this phenomenon, the radical Islamic phenomenon, to fundraise, to recruit, and to base itself, you know, in those countries. That's where you can begin to see the beginning of the end.
We could start with the company that gets all those no-bid contracts.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ray. Here's Perry, who writes, Mr. Rushdie, why is it that the religious leaders are able to pass a worldwide injunction against you but not against terrorists?
Good question. I guess, put it this way, the injunction against me didn't work. I mean, it's not clear whether the injunction against anyone else would work. But it would be, people have said more than once that there has been no such edict, and I think that's regrettable.
Here's another listener who sends this email. Given that many Muslims in the Netherlands have found citizenship in a liberal and pluralistic society, do you see that country as a European testing ground for whether Islam can live side by side with people of divergent beliefs? And do you believe there is a silent majority of Muslims who believe this is possible?
I hope so. I mean, I think it's about time it stopped being silent. And I think in the particular case of the Netherlands, there's a problem which has been created by the murder of the filmmaker Theo van Gogh, which has plunged that extremely liberal country into a frenzy of self-examination and you know, wondering whether it's been too liberal. And so, in a way, great damage has been done to that possibility there. You know, but what I was trying to do in this book was to show really how our stories are all connected. You know, it used to be, it never used to be the case that in order to understand something happening in California, you would have to look across the world. And I think, in a way, that's the one sense in which I would say this is a post 9/11 novel, because I think the thing that we all saw on 9/11 was the story of one part of the world literally physically smashing into the story of New York, you know, and uniting those two stories forever. And I think, well, you know, a lot of those people on those planes were going to L.A., so of course it affected in many ways the story of Los Angeles as well. So I think now it's very important as an act of understanding, which is frankly an act of understanding is always the first step to any kind of solution of anything, to start seeing how our story in America is tied up with the stories of very remote parts of the world. And I think there's some signs that American readers are very interested in this, because if you look at the success of books in recent years, like Reading Lolita in Tehran, like The Kite Runner, you know, who would have thought a few years ago that books like this would have spent years and years on U.S. bestseller lists? And I think the reason that they do is because people feel that the information they need, you know, the information of human understanding that they need, is not being given to them by the so-called information media. You know,
you mentioned New York and the smashing in and the connection of the stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Los Angeles came perilously close to being tied to Algerian terrorists who were trying to get in over Canada and blow up LAX. And
yes,
certainly that changed the security in LAX. It mm-hmm. changed people's lives. Had it occurred, had it been brought into fruition, it would have been, you know, catastrophic and colossal in terms of. And I think you're absolutely right. I think we see it, those of us who work in the media, in a tremendous spike in interest just in international relations.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time it was being ignored. I mean, it was a celebrity culture almost entirely.
Yes. And actually, well, I have to say, one of the things I'm really pleased about since I'm here in San Francisco is that I, at one point in the novel, my character, Shalimar the Clown, after he's arrested, he's in jail in San Quentin. You know, the San Quentin bit of this book is something I'm particularly pleased about in terms of my crossing borders, you know, because obviously I've never been on death row, but I did a lot of digging around. And one of the things I discovered, which was astonishing and unsuspected, is that there are prisoners on death row who have blogs, who have weblogs, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, rather intermittent ones, where they talk about their daily lives. And it becomes a way of learning what a writer needs to know, which is the tiny details of everyday life, you know, in a way that even if you were to go in there and talk to them, you might not find those things out. You know.
And, so you were reading these blogs, yeah.
Yeah, and I found out amazing tiny things. I mean, like, for instance, you know, you get given a mug for coffee, you know, and your jail cell has a sort of like letterbox-shaped slot in it. And when it's coffee time, you stick your mug out through the slot, and the guy coming past, you know, is pouring the coffee, hot coffee, you know, while moving. And if it scalds your hand, which you're holding out, if you drop the mug, you don't get the mug back. You know, so if you want to have coffee, you've got to be put up with having your hand scalded. Little details like that are what bring a world to life, you know. And in a novel which tries to show how, you know, a Kashmiri terrorist can end up in San Quentin, the thing that's really important is to bring each world properly to life, you know. And actually, the little bit of a chapter that's in San Quentin is one of the bits I'm most proud of.
On we go. We're joined now by Michael. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Solomon.
Hello.
Hello, Solomon. Yeah, I was wondering two questions. What to any extent is the book autobiographical? And I read a recent review in the New Yorker by Upton Sinclair, which I thought was excellently done. I wondered what your...
I mean, Upton Sinclair has been dead about...
John Updike.
I think, oh, John
Updike. I'm sorry.
50 years dead. I think, yeah.
I'm always learning from you, Michael. And I was wondering how you felt about that and... to what extent is drug cultivated in Kashmir Valley? I mean, when in the 60s we used to smoke hash from the Valley of Kashmir, and that was rather exotic. Or was that just a fallacy?
I think there's more hashish there used to be in Afghanistan than in Kashmir. But I'm sure there was a bit there too. I don't think the book is very autobiographical at all, except in that I have had to think about issues of terrorism, violence, fanaticism, and indeed power, you know, for in quite a lot of detail in the last decade and a half. And one of the things, and so, you know, it does come out of that. It comes out of that long period of reflection. But there isn't a me character in the book. There isn't a character who represents the author or his opinions in the book. And I rather like that. I like the fact that these are characters that you can't easily make your mind up about. Sometimes you're on their side, sometimes you're not. Shalimar the Clown begins as a sweet boy. He ends up, you know, as a much darker character. But in a funny way, your feelings towards him, I think, are tugged back and forth even when he is a man of violence. His wife, who leaves him for the American ambassador, you know, we might well lose sympathy for her when she breaks his heart and runs off to pursue her future. But, you know, it doesn't work, and she certainly pays a very hard price for it in the novel. And I think when you see her later suffering, you know, I think the reader's sympathy comes back towards her. Max himself, you know, is a man of power based on many of those men of power that I met. I mean, I met Clinton and Chirac and Tony Blair and, you know, foreign ministers and ambassadors and so on. So it gave me a lot of useful material out of which to construct a genuinely powerful man in the modern world. And he's kind of a rogue, you know, he's very charming, he's very brilliant, he's kind of charismatic and sexy and so on. But
sort of like yourself, of course.
Exactly, that's the autobiographical character. and he does lots of you know, reprehensible things, including seducing other men's wives and so on, and he's completely unrepentant. And yet, because he's so lovable, he's constantly forgiven. You know, and I think one of the things that the book really explored was this strange paradox that sometimes we can forgive people who are totally unrepentant, while we cannot forgive people who genuinely repent. You know, so when Bunyi, Shalimar's wife, comes back devastated from the failure of her little escapade with Max and literally throws herself at his feet in the snow to ask for mercy, she is not forgiven. You know, and I think there's a strange balance in the book, which I hope readers will think about, which is this curious fact that repentance and forgiveness appear not to be connected to each other. You know, repentance is something done by the person who repents, and forgiveness is something done by the person who forgives, and there's no cause and effect relationship. You know, so as I say, Max's daughter, India, for instance, you know, who has much reason to be angry with him in many ways, yet completely forgives him. And Shalimar the Clown, who probably still loves his wife at the point where she returns from her escapade with Max, is unable to forgive her. And that's part of the human tragedy, I think.
It is indeed a novel about forgiveness, or the lack of forgiveness. And, I mean, it's always curious how... I mean, I remember when I first read your book on Wizard of Oz, how much and to what extent I thought, you know, this is a man who's always worked with binaries. I mean, and still continues to work with binaries here. The book, again, is Shalimar the Clown. Salman Rushdie will be appearing today at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 1 p.m. Tonight at Books Incorporated in Mountain View at 7:30, and tomorrow at the Berkeley City Club at 7:30. Always a delight to have you and be with you.
It's great to be here again.
We'll be back with you tomorrow. We're going to talk tomorrow in this hour with Price Cobbs about his new memoir. He's, of course, the co-author of Black Rage, a book which was quite a sensation a number of years ago, and African-American leading psychiatrist. We're also going to talk in the opening hour about the Supreme Court nomination, which was announced today, of executive advisor Deborah Myers. Excuse me. Harriet Myers, I'm sorry. Into too many Myers. We'll be back with you on tomorrow. Hope you will join us for that. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated at night. Forum's producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Kevin Guillory, and Ariana Picari. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.